welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Maximilian Bezenski, who's doing a PhD in philosophy under the supervision of Dr. John Miller. Welcome to Grad Chat, Maximilian.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And as usual, before we dive into your research, I do like to ask people a little bit about how they came to be at Queen's in the first place. So what has your academic journey been like so far?
Sure. Probably a little strange. I'm from Regina, Saskatchewan, originally, and I did my undergraduate there at the University of Regina. I actually started in engineering.
Okay.
And then sort of 3 years into that, figured out that wasn't the way forward and switched into philosophy, committed myself to going to graduate school, and then applied all around a little bit. And Queen's was a wonderful opportunity, the best opportunity of those that were there. And I moved to Kingston in, about, I guess, three and a half years ago now. And I did a MA in philosophy first and applied to PhDs around again, but also added in an application because of how competitive PhD applications can be, added in an application to do a classics MA here as well as a sort of fallback because my research is in ancient philosophy, as we'll get to. So that kind of made sense to an extra buffer. But then they accepted me into both programs anyway. And then after some sort of discussion, advice from my supervisors and so forth, the best way forward was to just sort of squeeze that two-year MA in the classics into 1 year, defer my PhD start by a year. And then so in the end, I did an MA in philosophy here, then a classics in archaeology MA here, and then started the PhD in philosophy here.
Oh, very nice. So yes, so not particularly linear, but still very relevant, it sounds like, the way you came to the program now. So you mentioned, like you said, that your research is related to ancient philosophy. So your topic is contemporary significance in Stoic ethics. Can you tell us a little bit about what that project looks like?
Sure. So it's the culmination of my last few years of research. I got interested in ancient philosophy at the end of my undergraduate and Plato especially and so forth, and then had picked up a little bit of Marcus Aurelius, whose Meditations are a bit of a popular book right now, and then I had a different project in mind for my first MA, but after that really just focused right into Stoicism and looked at, in my classics MA, the contemporary popularity of it, which we'll talk a little bit about in a bit. It's around the internet, floating around the internet a bit. And I took a look at that, and then that really helped me prepare to just dive into something properly full-bodied, I guess, for a four-year, you know, dissertation and PhD project, which is primarily a defense of Stoic ethics and their value for now. It falls into the category of virtue ethics.
Okay.
As opposed to something like consequentialism or utilitarianism, might be a familiar one, or deontology, Immanuel Kant maybe might be a familiar name, or something like a religious ethics or Christian ethics falls into that kind of rule-based system. But this is properly Greek, obviously, and that whole time period and philosophers, all of their sort of ethics focus on whatever virtue is and being a good human being in character and developing and cultivating a good character for the sake of flourishing and being happy in a sense, or achieving a state of eudaimonia is the Greek word, which sometimes we translate as happiness, but more so it's really doing well as a human being, flourishing. So Stoic ethics fits squarely into that ballpark, focusing on virtue, and I think it's a well-placed ethical system for now and the details that they go into, and I aim to, through a series of topics about today's issues, sort of defend Stoic arguments as a positive force, or can be. They are a bit of hopefully a positive role now. They're gaining a bit of popularity online and so forth. And I think that's good, but more can be said sort of more formally from an academic perspective on how those ethics can be productive now. I guess I'll say that.
No, that makes sense. And it's, I think, like you said, it's Stoicism and those ideas are hitting kind of pop culture again, although I'm sure they never really leave, but they reemerge at different times. And right now they seem to be reemerging. But I think it might be helpful if you could explain, like, what is Stoicism as someone who studies it for, you know, our audience? What is Stoicism?
For sure, of course. Well, it's a Greek philosophy in its origin from post-Plato, let's say, post-Socrates after that, but following in the Socratic tradition, stemming from, you know, about that time, let's say, until roughly the reign of Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor in the second century. So that's roughly the end, spans from about the Greek origins, moves over to Rome, and sort of booms, especially in the ethics, in the context of Rome and the Roman Stoic philosophers, really starts to focus on ethics. And that's more so the ones that I'm interested in. Not that the Greek philosophers didn't talk about ethics, but it was a little bit more robust on the themes. So it's a importantly holistic philosophy in that they try to make their doctrine consistent throughout all philosophical topics. They talked about metaphysics or physics or sort of what we call natural philosophy and ethics and logic, epistemology, and they intend it all to fit together. Every proposition is consistent with the others and or is, you know, based on more basic claims. So it now has gained some ground, especially through authors like Marcus Aurelius, sort of the last Stoic philosopher-ish. It's, you know, debatable whether he's properly Stoic, but he's at least influenced. He's reading the previous Stoic philosophers from the Greek and then Roman tradition. And the most famous work that people may be familiar with, if they've heard of Stoicism at all, is going to be Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. And then maybe some of Epictetus's Handbook, we call it, or the Enchiridion is the Greek word of it, or they may have heard of Seneca and his extensive works. So those are what are sort of circulating largely. And then there's, of course, their predecessors in the Greeks, like Chrysippus or Zeno, people may have heard of. Zeno's Republic, people may have been familiar with. But for the last decade and a half, something like this, it's kind of surged in popularity. And there's a few reasons for, you know, how to track the trend of the growing sort of cultural popularity and phenomenon of it, which we, you know, may or may not get into. But some, you know, for example, COVID was apparently a big factor in the increased sales of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, just as one example. But before that, I mean, is a bit of a larger trend from about the 70s, kind of 80s, when academics picked up Stoicism a little bit more, especially somebody named A.A. Long was fundamental to an increase in increased academic interest in Stoicism. And that came around the time of a bit of a push of an academic interest in virtue ethics more generally, which turned into other things like modern forms of virtue ethics. But there's still a pretty good interest in virtue ethics in the academy, Greek virtue ethics. So there, that hopefully that situates what Stoicism is.
Yeah, no, it gives. So it sounds like it's, I mean, in how you reference to COVID, right? When it makes sense that during a time of a lot of upheaval and change, that people are looking for a holistic approach to living a good life or to living well. They're looking at their, you know, during COVID, as we all remember, you know, in lockdown and different things, maybe our lives weren't looking as well as they could. So we're looking at, makes sense that people were looking to others and figures who've, you know, lived well in the past to say, okay, well, what did you do to make sense of their current situation?
Well, it's an easy philosophy to make very personal and appeal very personal on the individual level, especially with something that's just called The Meditations. And it's Marcus Aurelius's Personal Reflections, a book that was never meant to be published from himself. So it's something a reader can easily relate to, I think. And they are authors that focus a lot on personal development, and especially what's popular is how they handle the emotions. And at a time like COVID and other examples now, which we could get into, are examples of problems where people are looking for personal solutions to difficult emotions like depression, anxiety, or anger, even at the world and social situations. And the Stoics talk a lot about how to regulate one's own emotions. And that's a big popular point of attraction and something that I talk a lot about in my research now.
So could you tell us about kind of some of your interest in Stoicism? You started to touch on them a little bit and maybe some of how those interests are showing up in how topics you're addressing in your dissertation research itself.
Sure. Well, exactly like I touched on then, my immediate appeal was probably the same kind of popular appeal, the things they have to say about the emotions, the most radical proposition of which, and interesting, is to place essentially total responsibility for emotions on the feeler, let's say, of those emotions. They are not only your own responsibility, your emotions are your responsibility, not only in a technical sense, well, both in a technical sense and a moral sense. So now it gets a little complicated in the responses, but to lay it out initially, yes, it's sort of a moral blame is maybe a too loaded a word, but one can be blamed for their own emotions in the sense that they're your own fault in the sense of if you have a character fault, there's something a little bit off about you. If you have too quick of a temper, that might be a character fault, character deficiency or something like that. And that is something that resides in you and the way you are. So that is where we can look to if we want a solution to that emotion. They're not going to say, let's find something that happened out in the world that made you feel bad. They're going to find that cause technically in your own self. So for example, if I do lose my temper, let's say, that's an easy one, because I spilt my milk or something, you know, don't cry over spilt milk. Well, they're going to agree with that in a very technical sense, and that, well, it's you that responded to the milk falling over. Now there's a huge mess to clean up. And if I get upset about that, that emotion resided in my processing. They're going to say judgment, my judgment, my reasoning about the event. But even if for, you know, modern scientific reasons, we don't like that word, you know, judgment, like it all resides in how you think and you can just change it that, you know, that easy. That is kind of what they say, but now there's some modern, you know, psychoanalysis that might, you know, sort of try to pinpoint, you know, more brain function. But that aside, they are trying to at least identify very basically that your reaction to the spilt milk and being upset resides in your mind. And the mind is something we could change to not have a reaction. It's very possible that somebody else could have a reaction to the spilt milk and never get upset. So in that very logical kind of way, it wasn't the milk being upset or somebody even more controversially, maybe someone who insults you. You know, we might want to say, well, you made me upset. You hurt my feelings. But it's very possible that somebody else could be on the receiving end of the same kind of insult, and they never get upset at all. They're not phased whatsoever. And so you wonder, okay, so there's case A where you had this insult and the person didn't get upset. And there's case B where the person did get upset. And so it seems like the cause of getting upset is actually not in the outside world. It's not in the insulter. They don't actually have the power to make you upset, even if they want to. It technically is with you, and that gives you now some control. Well, it doesn't give you, it's just there, they argue. You are the one, you are the thing. It's up to you how you feel in a very real way. Now, it's that's not to say it's easy to just change it all, but that's the way it is. And that's to a lot of opposing modern views is going to come across radical and controversial in those kinds of moral senses, where we want to blame something else a lot of the time for how we feel. And they say no. So that is, to come back to the question, is a big appeal for my interest in it, and something that a lot of people find value in. And there's a whole swath of consequences from that kind of basic position to appropriate behavior and personal development and cultivation as a person and a good person, and something that can help you find especially peace for people in troubled times. That's largely why it seems like people do get interested, is because people are online and they're maybe feel alone a lot of the time, isolated, especially more and more today for a whole host of other reasons why we're more and more isolated. But then something like Stoicism, people can come across on the internet where maybe they already are on social media, and they find something like this that gives them a real sense of ability to make a change. Alongside, it's not special, it's alongside a lot of other online, you know, content creators and people on YouTube and so forth who give this air of encouragement, I guess, that you can and do something for yourself. There's, you know, tons of other examples.
So that's one issue you're addressing in your dissertation. Are there other areas you're exploring and that you see that you're pulling apart to see how Stoicism still appeals and still has relevance in the modern era? What are some other topics that you're doing the same kind of analysis to?
Sure. There's about maybe seven different topics I could talk about right now that'll, you know, become chapters in their dissertation. So maybe I'll walk through each of them and you can jump in.
Sounds with a question good. If
you like. The first thing I address in my dissertation, or will address, is a little bit of a more technical problem before I kind of move properly to the how great the ethics are.
You've got to lay the foundation, right, to bring people into the work, right?
Yeah, it's the problem of, might be a little complicated to explain, but I'll do my best. There's a metaphysical problem in Stoicism that is a bit debated right now. And it needs to be addressed to be able to say that we can, in fact, you know, continue a Stoicism. We're not just cherry-picking their advice, we can actually act in the way they're suggesting. We can take a full holistic approach to our lives and our ethics and be Stoics, if one is so interested in that. And we're not just picking a little final conclusion of their arguments. We're really taking the whole thing. And the problem in doing that a lot of people find is the religious framework that the Stoics in their context are coming from, that them being in the time of Greco-Roman religion, Zeus and all the rest of them. And for the Stoics, that comes out in their philosophy in terms of a god or providential divine kind of order in the world. I won't go into their arguments for defending it, but they find the world to be ordered rationally by something divine. And we now, or most academics or interested parties generally in the culture, aren't really interested in that. They're coming from a more secular attitude generally, and they want to, or just do, ignore or disregard those metaphysical or religious, maybe pseudo-religious underpinnings in that. They don't want to worry about when they take the ethics and how great those are. Mm-hmm. They don't want to worry about, oh, I have to now subscribe also to these sort of religious underpinnings I don't feel make sense for today. And unfortunately, you can't really get away with that. Some academics want to then try to figure out how can we extract the ethics that we like from these sort of, you know, divine notions. And you kind of can't. And in my first chapters, I try to argue for how we can still make sense of it. And in a certain kind of a way, we can subscribe to those metaphysical notions of there being a rational ordering to the world. And I'll explain a little bit, try to just very briefly and simply explain how I see that can work now. So the most basic and crucial ethical axiom from the Stoics is that you should act in accordance with nature. And by nature, they mean the universe, this thing that rationally orders itself in a kind of a deterministic fashion. So you want to act along with it, go along with it, because you can't really do otherwise. It's all kind of fated. And they use these words like fate. You have to follow fate anyways. So go along with it. Act in accordance with. And the way you're going to do that is using your reason. The world is reasoned. It's ordered in according to a reason. And the way you're going to follow it is to use your human reason. So that's like their most basic position on ethics. That's how you're going to be wise and good and virtuous. So there's necessarily this component of subscribing to this rationally ordered kind of a world, which maybe makes people a little weary. But I do think it can make sense. And there's some, I rely on a work I looked at recently. This was a problem sort of for the last couple of years of my being interested in this. And I now, through another very interesting course on hermeneutics and phenomenology, which may be sort of strange, you know, philosophical terms for the audience, but phenomenology is just a philosophical branch of trying to assess phenomenon in a very plain and straightforward kind of way, just describing it as it appears, we might say. So there is a contemporary phenomenologist, by the name of Jeff Mitcherling, who I did a course on with Dr. Paul Fairfield here. And his central work from the year 2000, maybe it came out, maybe a little after that, doesn't matter, but was a book called Aesthetic Genesis, secondary title, The Origins of Consciousness in Intentional Being, something like this, which sounds very complicated, probably. And I rely on it to basically find a modern example of something that sounds very much like what the Stoics are getting at when they talk about the divine ordering of everything, when he relies on this concept of intentionality in his work, that there's in the world, it sort of has direction. And he argues it from a very modern kind of point of phenomenological point of view. And he tries to be very much a realist about approaching the world, not necessarily in a secular way. He doesn't necessarily get into that kind of debate about secular versus non-secular, but just kind of leave it just with that, without getting into too many details, that he does argue in a convincing kind of a way, and you know, people can maybe look it up if they want to know more. His arguments can get kind of funny, but that there is some sort of intentionality which can be read as a bit of directionality to the world. And that seems to me, in my kind of first chapters, that I argue that is kind of what the Stoics are getting at. And we can kind of read them like him, or like a realist phenomenologist is the kind of camp he's in. And that in the end, the conclusion being that the Stoic metaphysic is just as well of a contender, basically, in other sort of philosophies of metaphysics. It's not not something to scoff at. And so, therefore, we can actually genuinely be Stoics, basically. Mm-hmm. We can continue that school and not say, oh, all of their metaphysical stuff doesn't matter, mm-hmm. because it has to. You can't really extract it, I don't think. So there is a way to read them such that we can say we are now Stoics, or some sort of following in that real tradition. So that's the first one.
Yeah, it seems to make sense because, like you said at the beginning, that it's a holistic approach and a holistic philosophy. So to for people to leave out the context in which these ethics were developed seems kind of impossible to do. as and then so by you making this more modern interjection, like you said, using some work of more contemporary phenomenologists to still read those ethics as and metaphysics as they are, but to read them in a way that makes sense with the world in the 21st century, just as it would, you know, reading it differently in the context of it was written, you know, in ancient times. So what are some other issues that you're addressing in your dissertation? And why do you think it helps Stoicism be an important set of ideals to promote in response to present circumstances, as opposed to, you know, other philosophies or approaches?
Sure. I'll try to go through all of them as best I can the time we have briefly, because that one is the only complicated one, and the rest of it is squarely in here. The ethics are great. They're wonderful. We can use them today. So I split them kind of into, there's some social issues and maybe some individual issues. Mm. People are very interested in it personally for their lives, developing their lives. So there's some personal things we can talk about, but there's also some social issues that I think it applies to. So one is something I get asked about a lot when I presented on it or talking to just people I know casually, is people worry a little bit about Stoicism being an interest more so of just men.
Mm.
And there's sort of questions there. Mm. Is that what's going on there? Should we be critical of that? Or why aren't women just as interested in it? Is there something about Stoicism such that it should appeal to men more? Or is there something either, you know, sort of the nature-nurture kind of thing? Is there nurture reasons, social reasons, why it might lean towards men's interest? Or is there also nature reasons why it may lean more towards men? Well, interestingly, the answer is yes, it does seem to lean towards men, especially online.
Mm.
But it may firstly be more complicated than that, because some of these online platforms apparently, from what I've seen, do skew already towards men, like YouTube, where a lot of people digest this thing, or Reddit even as well, where there's a significant group called, you know, r/Stoicism is relatively big, some 700,000 members or something. And these platforms already are maybe leaning towards men. So the fact that you see that is maybe makes a little bit more sense. If you do look to, there is a little bit of interesting data on it from the organization called Modern Stoicism, who have some events every year and some courses, and they track a little bit about the interest. And the demographics that they tracked over the last maybe 10 years or so are a little more even than people maybe initially think. It's maybe the kind of 60-40 thing to men showing up and being interested. So it may not be as one-sided as people might think. But at the same time, I do think there are more reasons. Now, this might be a little controversial at times, but I do think there is a reason Stoicism probably does generally in the culture appeal to more to men, and them wanting to have a sense of control and discipline over themselves. I think does appeal to men more so a little bit. And one argument I rely on that from a popular book from the 80s called Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus by John Gray. And just to go into it very briefly, and then I'll move on to something else, is he does argue men's solution to problem solving is to kind of go off by themselves and sort of figure it out themselves. And they lean towards that more so than women being working through emotional issues, especially when we focus on emotional issues, talk it out with friends or something like that. And he makes this kind of argument, and that seems about right to me. And I think Stoicism does kind of offer that kind of thing, especially when it's just available online and through social media, for men to just sort of go on the internet, go away in their cave, as John Gray will call it. They say they need to go, he needs to go away to his cave and sort of figure it out himself, and then he'll come back and he'll be right as rain. And so for men to just kind of go into their cave or their computer cave or whatever, do their little research, find something like Marcus Aurelius, work through their emotional problems themselves, and then come out right as rain. So I think that kind of thing, it is why it appeals, sort of works a little bit more for men. And Stoicism, in the way it's just set up, kind of allows you that kind of, it encourages that kind of thing. It encourages you to be rational and to reason through your emotions, and that you can do it just yourself. Not that they don't say friends aren't great. They say friends are great, and talking to people is great. But they do allow you sort of a philosophy for doing it yourself. So that's one issue. Men and women and the relationships in between is one chapter. The Stoics, I hope to comment, make Stoic commentary on and defend it. So two more social issues are, one, emotions, very centrally, strong emotions in the culture, socially, around vast amounts of depression and rage is kind of the way I'm seeing it. Two very opposite kind of poles of emotions, furious anger and deep sadness and depression kind of things. And the making Stoic sort of commentary, a Stoic response to that trend today is will become another chapter. Mm-hmm. So what I identify as the problems to comment on are that we can see clearly things like, it's relatively common knowledge to see increasing depression rates, anxiety rates, suicide rates, all these kinds of things. It's sort of common knowledge. We know there's kind of a crisis about that. And my aim is to make sort of a new commentary on Stoicism as a valuable approach to that problem, as opposed to especially something like the extreme amount of promotion of pharmaceutical kinds of remedies is something I will be arguing against, and in favor of something like a Stoicism or a philosophical approach in general, for one, is better than pills, quite frankly. So that will be one topic that you will be more rewarded by finding, curing the cause of the emotional trouble that resides in you again, like the Stoics say. You can actually make changes in your life, and you don't have to focus so much on pharmaceutical remedies. To put it simply, sort of sum up that sort of topic like that. And I think a lot of people are starting to see that. There's some research coming out on being critical of things like pharmaceutical remedies being not as effective as once thought. And there's a lot of people who are interested, like online, and who are finding things like Stoicism or other content creators on YouTube who are a big voice in, you can make changes to your own life. So Stoicism, fits into that, and I'll sort of be defending that. But even more interesting to me is the problems of anger right now. Stoics say all basically things we would call negative emotions are misjudgments. You're wrong to be upset in basically any way, anger included. Anger, sadness, grief, distress of any kind are you looking at the world and thinking incorrectly about it. And I see a great deal of anger today, whether it be about Trump. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. People are outraged about that. Other social justice issues, race, gender, sex, all of these things. There's a great deal of anger, especially we can see on campuses across North America and beyond. Students are very angry, and it's easy to see it online or on campuses. We see reports all the time. Or again, more generally, anger at social justice kinds of issues, especially in terms of things like relations between, you know, Canada and the States. I'll forego any more examples, but I think people do kind of see that people are pretty enraged. And I kind of look at that and I think, why? I don't see it as productive. And there are arguments from pretty major philosophers who do argue that to be angry about social issues is productive and is going to get us a better world, to put it simply. And that's firmly opposite to Stoic kind of ideals. They argue firmly against anger being a useful way to improve people and the world. Anger is a character fault. Put quite frankly, the Stoics are very frank, often, entirely. And how much more should I say on that? Well, I'll sum up that by saying that the Stoic position is that when you are angry, you are judging there to be something bad happening. An injustice was made to you, and now you incorrectly desire revenge. That's how Seneca will define anger. A desire for revenge when you, it appears like you've been harmed. But they will go on to argue all consistently that the only thing that ever harms you is you, basically. Your emotions are, again, up to you. So if something upset you in the world, you being upset is a result of your thinking. And so you're wrong to be angry because you're wrong that the world harmed you or wronged you. That's not to say that something like justice isn't something to pursue, because that's one of their cardinal virtues that they follow in the tradition of the Greek, the four cardinal virtues of the Greeks are wisdom, temperance, courage, and justice. And so justice is through and through a very important part of their philosophy and ethics, but there are better ways to achieve the results of justice without losing yourself. Maybe a good way to put it is that if we do achieve certain social ends through means of anger that leads to a social movement, let's say, then we end up with a bunch of angry people, even if we make a change, and we're not really going to be better off if we all sacrifice our own characters. Or, in another very simple way to put it, we can make social change and do all the things we want to do without raising our blood pressure. You can say, here's where we should go. Let's all move to that goalpost without having a heart attack, in a very sort of physical way of looking at being unhealthy emotionally. And they do talk about the emotions that way in terms of health, that frequently it's like an illness to be in vice, in character flaw is like an illness. So we don't want to make social change and then just end up with a bunch of sort of ill people kind of thing. That's maybe a good way to think about it. So I'll leave the rage topic at that and move on to at least the last social issue, which is probably the more interesting of the topics anyways. If we don't end up with time for the sort of personal subjects. So the final social issue that I try to address in my dissertation chapters and make a Stoic response to the phenomenon regards free speech and censorship in the culture, let's say. So before I explain the sort of Stoic response to it and how I'll defend it, is that what I see as an issue is, especially as an academic and a philosopher, if I can be called such, at least a student of philosophy, I'll say, is, you know, that's sort of the most important thing, you know, even to me personally, is to be able to do what I do by thinking whatever I will think, mm-hmm. and have everybody else do the same, so we can all be free to think about what we like and work through it and figure out something, whatever we're going to figure out, the truth, whatever you want to call it. The truth is what, you know, philosophers are largely interested in, what I'm interested in, but even to just express whatever you will and have mm-hmm. it go wherever you want it to go. And then we can all do that without being upset at one another for anything. We can all kind of just chill out a little bit. That's personally an issue to me. And the Stoics follow up on that very, very well. So I don't think it'll come off as a surprise to anybody for me to claim that there's a lot, it will be controversial, but there's a lot of censorship in universities and the broader culture, and that free speech is hotly debated as something, well, okay, up to a point, and where that limit is going to be is hotly debated right now, whether on whatever issue it may be that's politically popular. I mean, there's sort of too many examples to sort of get into, but I think people generally kind of know what I'm talking about. I mean, through social media, how much should that be regulated? What can people say on there? That there, it doesn't, it's not beholden to a government body necessarily, or should it be? And, you know, Twitter or something like that, or I guess X now. People are wondering, you know, before, okay, it should have so many regulations on it for what people can say on there. What's hateful? What's not? Is that okay? And then, you know, people don't like Elon Musk this is one reason. A lot of people don't like him. He takes over and he says it's more free. You can kind of say whatever you want with less regulation on there. And people are wondering about that. And, you know, Facebook, you know, follows suit similarly. And then on campuses, there's, you know, what speakers should we have? There's throughout the last decade, there's so many examples of this speaker, that speaker being shouted down, or no, you shouldn't say, you shouldn't be here, or you should be here for this and that reason. And so it's a very contested topic. And I, as well as the Stoics, fall on the side of a more maximally free speech. And the Stoic response to the issue is basically speech should be allowed to be directed at the truth, especially they following there's a Greek word, parhesia, which we kind of translate as free speech a lot of the time. And it really refers to a sort of cultural practice of that sort of encouragement of just open dialogue and truth seeking. And that's kind of what the Stoics follow in the tradition of and defend. And crucially, they don't want to put limits on any sort of speech based on negative emotions, let's say, especially. They might have practical concessions, like there's talk of, okay, maybe we have an orator in the public forum and he's kind of wasting everybody's time. So let's kick him out of here because this is just not, we only have so much time in the day. That's maybe, you know, there's something to be said there about there almost only being so much time to speak about this or that. But they don't want to limit what we can speak about because of something like, because of emotions. To give sort of frank examples, or here's one example of the kind of thing that they're not going to be in favor of is something like a trigger warning. If you familiar kind of with that idea of, I'm about to show you some content, but be warned, it might upset you. And if it does upset you too much, then either maybe you should leave, or maybe we shouldn't show you or anybody at all because it might upset somebody. So that's something that's a current potential issue in university classrooms. And beyond that, even there's a trend of worrying about how speech will affect the emotions of the listener. That's a big emphasis. And there's a book I rely on pretty heavily to sort of describe this phenomenon by authors named Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. And they talk at great length about this cultural phenomenon of, as they put it, preparing the road for the child rather than preparing the child for the road. So their metaphor there means that instead of strengthening training, like a child to be a driver and to navigate the obstacles of the road, well, instead, let's just make sure there are no obstacles in the road, and then the kids will be all right, and they'll never be upset when we break from the analogy. If we remove all the things that might distress them in university or life, then they're going to be great. They're never going to be upset. And from that attitude spawns censorship practices. So, no, you can't say this because that'll be an obstacle to somebody's mental well-being. And that is an argument that is relatively popular or even dominant. And the Stoic perspective is kind of, no, that's ridiculous, because it'll never solve the problem. You will always have, and they have little anecdotes along the way that are kind of funny sometimes, like there'll always be someone to insult you. You're never going to cure the world of obstacles. So the more productive response is to strengthen the individual to come to grips and not be bothered at the end of the day, because there is no reason to ever be upset from their framework. If you hear something, there's no reason to be upset. And maybe it's difficult, but it is necessary to come to grips with. So long story short, that's a significant topic.
So it sounds like you're covering a lot of ground in your dissertation. And I want to thank you so much for coming on today. And it's been great chatting with you. Thanks for doing the show, and best of luck with the rest of your research. We'd love to have you on again to chat more as your project develops. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. And until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.